The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Well, I don't need to ask you to give a warm welcome to David Mitchell.
Thank you very much.
My name is Claire Armistead. I'm the books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This is the second of our new series of reader events, and I'm particularly thrilled to be doing this because David is a writer I have been watching since, in fact, 1998, which is
really?
Before Ghostwritten, his first novel, was published, because his first emergence was as an unpublished writer when A.S. Byatt, no less a person, asked him to share a stage at a very short-lived London festival to do a reading because she had read it in manuscript and was so impressed by it. She said, we have to feature this young writer. So that is real prescience, isn't it?
Bless her.
And since then, five of them have been long-listed for the Booker, including this one. He plays with the form in all sorts of ways, including having just written a Twitter novel, some people were calling it.
Short story.
Which ran over a weekend. You can see on the Guardian Books website if you happen to have missed it, because it actually does relate to The Bone Clocks, which we're talking about now. David is going to start by reading a bit from it.
I do have to apologise to any Norwegians in the audience, because I'm about to butcher your language alive in front of you. Actually, are there any Norwegians in the audience? Oh, no! I'm so sorry. Are you brave enough just to come up and read this out, and read this address out? You wouldn't mind, fantastic.
Oh!
So, this is a letter that's sent in the year 2025 from this address.
Øvre Fjellbergskole for døve, Gransveien 13, 7032 Trondheim, Norge / Norway.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Anyway, it's 15th of March 2025, and the letter goes like this. Dear Marinus, first, I beg your pardon. I don't know if Marinus is Mr. or Mrs. or Doctor, your family name or your given name. Pardon also my poor English. My name is Argia Neas Erdegaard. Maybe Mrs. Esther Little told you my name, but in this letter I will assume she did not. I am a 74-year-old Norwegian man who lives in Trondheim, which is how we pronounce it, but not quite how, a town of my native Norway. In case you don't know why a stranger is sending you an old audio machine, here is the full story. My father established our school for the blind in 1932 because his brother Martin was... because his brother Martin was born with deafness, and in those days, attitudes were primitive. I was born in 1950, and I could sign fluently, in Norwegian, of course, before I was 10. My mother managed the office of our school, and my uncle Martin became the groundsman. So you can imagine, our school and its students were the life of our family. I graduated from Oslo University in 1975 with a degree in education, and I returned to Trondheim to teach at our school. I established a music and drama department here because, also, I love the violin. Many non-deaf people do not guess that deaf people can enjoy music in various ways. So it was our school's tradition to work with our local amateur orchestra to produce a spring concert for an audience of both deaf and non-deaf people. Signing, dance, amplification, images and so on are used. In 1984, when this story happened, I chose Jean Sibelius's The Swan of Twenola for our annual performance. It is very beautiful. Perhaps you know? Anyway, in 1984, we had one dark cloud above our landscape. Do you say this in English also? Namely, the financial position of our school was critical. We are a charitable foundation, but we required a big subsidy from Oslo to pay for our salaries and so on. I will not bore you with old politics, but the national government at that time cut our subsidy to oblige our students to attend another school 2 hours away by car. We protested the decision, but without financial independence or political muscle, our precious school was to be shut after half a century of excellent work. For our family, this was a tragedy. However, one day in June of 1984, I received a visitor in my office. She was in her 50s, perhaps. She had short grey hair and masculine clothes and a face of many stories. She apologised for disturbing me in a foreigner's Norwegian, then asked if we could speak English. I said yes. She said her name was Esther Little. Esther Little had attended our students' recent concert and enjoyed it greatly. She had also heard of the school's bad financial position and she wished to assist if possible. I said, if you have a magic wand, please, I am listening. Esther Little put a wooden box on my desk. This is the mahogany box I send to you today. Inside was a portable cassette player and one cassette tape. Then Esther Little explained this deal. If I keep these items for some years and then post it to her friend Marinus at an address in New York, she would tell her lawyers in Oslo to make a large donation to our school. Should I agree? Esther Little read my thoughts. She said, no, I am not a drug lord or a terrorist or a spy. I am an eccentric philanthropist from Western Australia. This cassette is a message to a friend, Marinus, who will need to hear it when the time is right. As I write this letter today, I don't know why I believed her, but sometimes you meet people who you believe. It is an instinct. And I believed Esther Little. Her Oslo lawyers were a respectable conservative firm, so perhaps this influenced my decision. I asked, why did she simply not pay her Oslo lawyers to post her box to New York on a certain date in the future? Esther Little said, lawyers come and go. Even discreet ones are visible, and they all work for money. But you are an honest man in a quiet corner of the world, and you will live a long time. Finally, she wrote down the donation she offered. I am sure my face became pale like a ghost when I saw the number on the sheet of paper. Our school would be safe for 5 years, at least. Esther Little said, tell your board of governors that the money was donated from a wealthy, anonymous donor who believes in the work you do here. This is the truth. The box and our deal should be our small secret, is what I understood. We shook hands. Naturally, my last question was, well, when do I post the box to Marinus in Manhattan? When? Esther Little took out a small porcelain statue of Sibelius from a box, put it on a high bookshelf, and said this. On the day Sibelius was smashed into many pieces, that day I must post the box. I thought I had not understood her English, so I examined her request carefully. If the statue broke next week, I must post the box next week. If it broke in the year 2000, I must post the box in the year 2000. If I die before the statue breaks, then I never post the box. Yes, that was the deal, said Esther Little. Like I said, I am eccentric. We said goodbye, and to be honest, when she was gone, I wondered if I dreamt her. But next day, the lawyer telephoned from Oslo for our bank account number, and every krona Esther Little promised was transferred. Our school was safed. 3 or 4 years later, the government ideas changed greatly, and big investment was made for our school. There is no doubt, Mrs. Esther Little rescued us at our worst time. In 2004, I became principal, and I retired a few years ago. But I am still a governor, and even today, I use my former office as a study. All those years, Jean Sibelius watched my office like a man who knows the secret. You can guess the ending, I think. Yesterday was the first mild day of spring. Like most people in Norway, I opened the window for make fresh air in my office. Students was playing on tennis courts below my window. I left my study to make my morning coffee. I heard a noise. When I returned, Jean Sibelius was on the floor. His chest and head was in many little pieces. There was a tennis ball near. The chance was 10,000 of one, but the time came. So I am sending the box, as I promised, with this strange story. I hope the message on the cassette is clear after 40 years, but I never listened it. If Mrs. Little is still walking this world, if so, surely she is over 100 years old. Give her thanks and regards from an honest man in a quiet corner of the world who has lived a long time indeed. Thank you.
Tell us about Marinus. Marinus is one of the revenants this novel.
I can reveal that in Thousand Autumns, my last novel, Marinus is a he, and he's a surgeon who works for the Dutch East Indies Company at this place called Dejima, their outpost in late 18th century Nagasaki. He can be grumpy and obstreperous, but he's also remarkably enlightened about women and slaves, and he's also remarkably unfazed about the prospect of his approaching death. We understand that in Thousand Autumns, he was on his, I think, 28th lifetime, whereas now she's on about her 34th lifetime. So that's why the name might ring some bells.
But when you come to this book, you suddenly thought, oh, my goodness, was in your mind that actually it's a wormhole through from another whole set of existences? So, i.e., you're building up a mythology of your own through your novels in which all these characters sort of bounce around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've intended to have Marinus. I talked through the idea with my brother in about 10 years ago, and he really liked the idea and said, oh, you've got to write that. So just his enthusiasm sort of was the little spark that brought Marinus into being, really. But yes, I've been thinking about him or her for a long time.
So, but this is a story of a book of six, almost self-standing, but yeah, very much linked. You could say each one is a novella in its own right.
I've recently made the slightly embarrassing discovery by my sixth book that I'm not actually a novelist at all. I'm a novella writer. That's my optimum form. And ghostwritten, you can argue, is sort of about 10 or 11 either very long short stories or very short novellas. Number Nine Dream, kind of. Cloud Atlas, most certainly, six novellas. It's something about that 70 to 130 sort of page form. It's long enough to kind of get revved up properly, but not so long that you risk running out of petrol.
So what is it that makes this a novel and not a series of short stories?
Good question. Firstly, they're stitched together or tubed together or linked. They're all about Holly. She narrates the first and the sixth, and she's minor turning into a major character in the Sandwiched Four. So she turns the six novellas into one. Also, the war between these two shadowy circles of pseudo-immortals, which explodes and then is instantly erased and erupts, and then is sort of, well, the Faustian pact is offered in the second section, and in the third section, it's sort of there as well. So the breath and the touch of characters from the war also appear in all of the sections 1 to 4 and 6. The fifth one, which is the one that I just read from, the focus is on the war.
What is extraordinary to me is if you were sort of on the third of them or the second, which some of you may well be still in the middle of it, you wouldn't know what you're talking about. And yet, once you've got to the end of it, it is all there.
My wife says that to me quite often, actually. It's got a hefty reveal. That's okay. Reveal is a form of
plot. But it's a reveal that then feeds back into what you've read before. You sort of need to then go back to the beginning and read it again, because then you can pick up all the stitches that you've been sewing all the way through the different stories.
I can only speak with surety for myself, but I like those kind of books. Isn't Master and Margarita a brilliant book? And don't you want to read that twice? These deep flotation tank novels that you sort of go into and luxuriate in, aren't they beautiful? So you can only really write for yourself and hope that what you find moving or entertaining or addictive, other people will as well. You can't know, you just hope.
I mean, it is almost perverse the way you've written this novel, because the genres are so different. So you say, yeah, if you were a fantasy fan, you've got a sort of nice, lovely, meaty fantasy section. Then there's a satire section, a sort of literary satire, and then the very first section where Holly is introduced is almost written like a YA novel, very knowingly. So you're really testing your audience. You've got a multiplicity of audiences that you're expecting to follow through all these different genres.
It may be publishing wisdom that only people who like crime read crime novels, or that only people who like fantasy read fantasy novels. No, though. A critic once, a rather dim jazz critic, apocryphally asked Duke Ellington, "Mr. Ellington, what is good jazz?" And he just sort of gave a sort of nonplussed shrug, and I imagine him tapping the ash from his monster joint and saying, "If it sounds good, it is good." And isn't that also true of genre? If it reads well, then it's a well-put-together book. And it has that quality where you're reading it and you haven't once looked at the page number since about page 12, and suddenly it's page 336. And how the hell did I get here? Yeah, that's really good writing, whatever genre it's in. It's a range of paints, and use it. And don't not dip your brush into other genre hues because of some perceived convention that you can't do that. So play.
And the second section introduces this really slithery sort of character called Hugo Lamb. Could be a member of the Tory government, couldn't he? And he's another of the character who he appeared in Black Swan Green as absolutely adored.
And that
makes Jason
the
sick by feeding him cigarettes when he's far too young to smoke. So there's this sort of intertextuality going on all the time.
I kind of think of my characters as rather grumpy, out-of-work actors who are kind of basically pissed off with me for having given them one role but then left them to dry or to hang. And then I'm working on a new book, and then I think of possible roles, and rather like the way corporations may advertise in-house before they then advertise before they contact the Guardian's jobs pages. Just see if there's anyone whose personality, whose chronology, whose texture might fit the role, and I give them a formal interview. It has been pointed out by people in my immediate domestic circle that I do talk to myself quite a lot, quite often in the shower, actually.
Are you talking to the characters or talking to yourself about the characters in the shower?
Yeah, I'm giving them job interviews in the shower. But, of course, it has to be in their voice. You have to sort of get their voice back. I'm a profoundly weird bloke to live with, I suppose. I mean,
we're going to move on to what we haven't talked about is the satire, and the next section
sure.
is satirical. And I know you're going to duck this one, because you always do, but you have your main character in this is Crispin Hershey, who is a novelist who is obsessed with the avoidance of cliché, who has written two books, which his books include Desiccated Embryo and Red Monkey. And
duck.
Now, who could this be?
No, it's me. It's a really ungrounded, megalomaniac me, with all my worst aspects, and he says things that I have too much tact to say. He says them. It's the monster in the mirror. It really isn't the eminent British novelist who I have a lot of respect for who you're referring to. It's the more I deny it, the guiltier I sound.
Well, I'm quite astounded that you deny it, because as I read it, it wouldn't have occurred to me that it was anything else. You have referenced his father in the very beginning of that chapter.
His father's not a novelist, he's a filmmaker.
But by name, you name check. I mean, it seems there are lots of Amis, since we will come out, this is Martin Amis we're talking about. I wonder whether your American editors have been at you about the possibility of libel writs and things.
Oh, no, I mean, in the States, absolutely not. You can say what the heck you want about anybody in the States. The animal thing is unfortunate, and I just read Yellow Dog at the time. Well, that's a good title. Desiccated Embryos is a piece of music by Eric Satie.
Eric Satie,
It's just, oh dear, what have I done?
You're saying it's a sort of subconscious association that you've let loose on this?
If it is an association, it is subconscious. I know I can't have the last word in how I am interpreted, but I will have the last word in what I meant. And
touché. Parenting is in this novel, isn't it? Yeah. Holly and parenting, is this a new thing for you?
One of the impossible things of that I'm trying to do in the book Before Breakfast is kind of an almanac of all the possible yet primal human relationships that there are. That's why there's a family, quite an involved, spread out, entangled one. So we got mother, daughter, father, daughter, of course, the other way around, sibling, sibling, brother, sister, sister, brother, the cousins, the aunts, the grandmothers, the lovers, the whatever it is between you if you have a child together, the widow and the dead. Yeah, I'm a dad, and that connects you, as you know, sort of with the universe in a whole new way. Sort of one umbilical cord is cut, and well, I'm a guy, I didn't have an umbilical cord, but kind of another is plugged in at the same time. You get to your mid-40s and you look in the mirror, and yeah, it's not this youngish person looking back at you. It's sort of your dad when you first got to know him looking back at you, or your mum. I said, "Dad, what are you doing in there?" And he said, "Dad, what are you doing in there?" Looking back at me, I said, "Oh, oh, no, no." And mortality is no longer this abstract thing that will happen to you one day or happens to very unfortunate people now. You feel it starting in your knees. And our society, our youth celebrating culture does not encourage us to form a healthy relationship with mortality. I think possibly other cultures do this rather better. This book is a way for me to sort of work through the permutations. A couple of people in it are given this, the possibility of this pact, this Faustian pact, which goes along these lines. Okay, you can basically be 25 or 30 forever. You get to keep your looks. What would you give for that? Would you, for example, amputate your conscience? Would you give your conscience in return for this? It's a deal I like to think I would refuse, but it's a deal I would certainly think about, I'd think through. There's a fictional problem with immortality, which is, well, what about other people? Won't they eventually notice in time that you're not ageing? Douglas Adams solves this problem somewhere by having his immortal take a professorship in Cambridge University, where nobody notices that he never dies.
You play with lots of different literary traditions in this, and you're playing with the vampire novel, aren't you? In fact, somebody makes a joke about it and says, oh, no, here comes the V word again.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a vampire novel, partly?
Metaphysically, it's a vampire novel. It's not blood, but it's souls.
Souls is very... I mean, is this a religious world?
Word?
Multiverse. Is it a religious concept? Soul is a very loaded word.
It's very loaded. Does it exist? And if it does exist, is it the same as the mind? Is the soul capable of remembering? Or is it something other than the mind? And these are exactly the same things that I was having to grapple with in my own humble way on my kitchen table in the west of Ireland after the kids had gone to bed, and writing the constitution of the part five, the more fantastical part. What are the rules? Yes, the soul exists. I didn't go all the way to religion. I ducked out of that with the dusk. There's the last ocean, the last sea, I call it, and this in-between place, which I sort of think as sort of dusty sand dunes going from something that's basically light, which is where life is, the day, kind of through this sort of sloping to this noiseless sea. I don't have God in it. So like New Labour, I don't do God.
One was this book. You probably can't see it, but a maze features. I don't know whether any of you can see this. There's a lovely silver, this is a proof, lovely silver maze on it. And one question is, did you actually draw the maze yourself?
Oh, bless the reader. Yes, I did. I drew it on a flight to Vienna last November. I liked drawing mazes, and even when I was a kid, I'd cover an area of paper the size of this with my poor parents, because then they had to do it. And they did do it to humour me, just to be fair.
The other one is, how, if at all, you've partly answered this actually, how, if at all, do you hear the voices of your characters in the shower is probably the answer to that, is it?
You write a letter to yourself from the characters. That's it. Literally, dear David, or if they're a bit cheeky, dear Dave. And you think about their educational level or their relationship with language. Would they use a word like synecdoche?
Ah, you've decided how to pronounce it. We were having an argument about how that would be pronounced.
We were having a fruitful discussion about those words that even fairly educated people are nervous about using out loud. Because
like lichen was the other one.
Lichen and
decide.
Lichen.
Lichen,
yeah.
Lichen. The trouble with, as in, because we were talking about his literary influences. But
John Wyndham, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone who have looked in my books would find letters headed Dear David. And they talk about, of course, I mean, it is really helpful. There's sort of about 5-10 key things that you need to know about non-existent people to kind of get a handle on them. Probably about a page or so. They don't need always to be that long. It's kind of enough to get you going. Mm. And then you kind of home in on them more once you're working with them. It's partly, it's a place to start.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
We're all going to have questions to ask, so we've got roving mics, so we don't spend a lot of time.
Someone in the roving mics would be a great name for a backing band.
Speaking of bands, I wanted to ask if you would mind talking about how you came to work with Kate Bush, who I've read she was shy about approaching you.
Oh, no, she's so gracious. Okay, it's nice to scotch one or two internet rumours here, so with pleasure. Actually, it was The Guardian what done it. Claire, or Claire's predecessor, asked me to do a piece for a section called My Hero about 7 years.
Lisa Allardyce. Yes.
Yeah. About 7 years ago or so, and I did one on Kate Bush because she's great, isn't she? A couple of Saturdays after, the phone went. Hello, David. It's Kate Bush. The rooms that went all Hitchcocky and hello. I love Under the Ivy. Why isn't it on iTunes? I love that. Why do you make me watch it on that crappy YouTube version? Please release it. Oh, sorry. Hello. Yes. So we just spoke for a little bit, and she was very gracious. While I fanboyed at her for 10 minutes and put the phone down, I thought with some relief. A couple of years later, I wrote the libretto for an opera that was on here in London, and just on the off chance, sent her an email. Da da da. I'm not really expecting. But if you're free, then you're very welcome to come along. And God, she did. We went out for a meal after that, and a few of, and some friends as well. And she was really, really nice and very kind, and exactly what you would wish Kate Bush to be. Then another 18 months or so later, I was sort of working on this, and again the phone went. Hello, it's Kate Bush. Would you be up for a meeting in London? And she preferred at that point not. And she is famously protective about her privacy and her anonymity, so a veil will start descending right now. But we did meet, and she said she was working on Before the Dawn, which didn't yet have a name, and she just had some ideas for a couple of very short dialogues. It isn't that I wrote lyrics for her. It isn't that I wrote those scenes. She provided notes. I turned that into a first draft, and then we ping-ponged it to and fro probably 6 or 7 times until she was happy with it, and that's where it stopped. So she knows exactly what she wanted, just sort of more a sounding board and some ideas for the characters and dialogue. I was a small cog in her wonderful, majestic machine.
Could you map out the life cycle of your writing? Like, how does it start? And then how refined is the plot before you start the book? Does it sort of flow, or where does it come from?
They have different starts. They're the sort of organisms made by one or more stem cells that sort of conjoin and blah. The time is in the sort of knuckle-chewing despair and fatigue and thorough fed-upness with the last book, with the previous book. The last 3 or 4 months it's not hard work in the sense of being a slave in a Bangladeshi factory making our clothes. It's hard work in the sense of you just can't really think about anything else, and you are vague and vacant, and you sort of kids ask you something at the table and you don't and you haven't noticed they've asked you stuff. It's hard in that sense. And during that time, it's sort of like the last stages of a quite bad past its sell-by date marriage, actually. And you, not that I have a very happy marriage to the same lady. You start to fantasize about a fling with a new book. And you know, if only I'd finished, if only I'd get rid of this Thousand Autumns thing, I'm going to translate everything into this old language, and I can't actually use my language, I can't speak, I like language, but everything's got to sound as if it's in the 18th sodding century, and I'm so tired of this. But the bone fox, Marinus comes back, ooh, and it's not in 1984, a golden apple, you touch it. And you start sort of thinking, you've got to finish this, and my poor, long-suffering editor can't go on holiday because I haven't handed this thing in yet, and deadline after deadline is trampled behind me, just a little November, December, it should be the new year, just sort of like roadkill, just left there. Crows are coming down at it. And it's at that time you really start to yearn to be free of it and to write the next book. Again, this is one of the kind of rightness decisions. You just kind of know that this is the next one. Like, you know that you're the one for me, baby. There's that connection with its potential and what it could be and this beautiful, shining, perfect thing you'd like to work on. Where does that come from? Just ideas. Where do ideas come from? The world, experience, things you overhear, things you hear on Front Row, things you read in The Guardian. Who knows, something you read in the front page of The Sun, things you see on the telly. The world, the compost heap.
It's the second time somebody's talked about compost heap ideas as compost heap recently.
Really? It must be in the air.
It's in the air. Compost is in the air.
You have the smile, which means I'm really digressing.
Be here all night. And the quality of the silence we've had in this room, apart from the laughter and everything, just is testimony to how brilliant you are. So thank you very much,
thank
David.
Thank you for coming. Really. Thank you.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.